Working Cows Podcast,
episode 222.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Egg Network, and very excited today to do a 2021 post-mortem with Jared Nock and Justin Frichte. They are with Millborn Seeds. They are on the Roots and Ruminants podcast. This might be the best-sounding podcast I've ever recorded. I don't know. It was a true recorded on both ends. They recorded on their end and I recorded on my end. Sorry, I'm getting podcast nerdy on you, but it was good. I really appreciated the opportunity to sit down with them and talk about just kind of what was 2021 like on both sides of this state. And I think it's representative of a lot of people's experiences around the United States and in other places as well. So really good conversation with them. And let me just say this. If you guys ever hear anything on the Working Cows podcast, not related to today necessarily, but if you ever have any questions or comments, concerns about what you hear, please reach out to me, workingcows.net/contact. Let me know, and I'll try to answer your questions if I am able to. One more note before we dive into this conversation with Jared and Justin from Millborn Seeds and the Roots and Ruminants podcast is that they will be with us at the Farm and Ranch Conference. You got a couple of weeks still to go before the Farm and Ranch Conference, January 21st and 22nd, Deadwood, South Dakota. January 21st, Elaine Frey's doing a three-hour succession workshop with people live in the room, answering questions. As she said, text me your toughest question anonymously, and we will answer that question live in the room. January 22nd, we've got Steve Kenyon in the morning for a soil health workshop, another 3 hours of him presenting. And then in the afternoon of January 22nd, we've got breakout sessions with Luke and Natalie Kavorik, or with Natalie Kavorik. Luke Kavorik will be participating in a round pen discussion with Justin Tupper from U.S. Cattlemen's Association and a few others. Heather Maud will be there talking about direct marketing in a breakout session and as part of the round pen discussion. But Justin Frichte and Jared Nock from the Roots and Ruminants podcast will be there recording a live podcast with Steve Kenyon talking about cover crops and soil health and some of those things. And that'll be a very interactive time opportunity to ask Steve questions and to be part of a live podcast recording. So again, I think this is one of those opportunities. It's worth the drive, worth the plane ticket. Get here January 21st and 22nd to Deadwood, South Dakota for the Farm and Ranch Conference put on by South Dakota and Wyoming Farm Bureaus. I think that's everything for this intro. So here is my conversation with Justin Frichte and Jared Nock of the Roots and Ruminants podcast and Millborn Seeds.
Well, welcome to this joint episode of Working Cows Podcast and Roots and Ruminants. Clay Connery. Clay, did I hear recently that your podcast has recently gotten 1 million downloads?
Yeah, since July of 2018, that's how far back the stats go. I started in November of 2017, but since July of 2018, I've got the hard data on a million downloads, from that time. So 200 and whatever episodes. Yeah, so.
That's fantastic. Obviously, Justin Frichte is here joining me as well. Looking forward to the conversation in which we're going to highlight some things that are going on, some things that are looking ahead, and getting ready to start a brand new year off in 2022. So we are joining from Eastern South Dakota. Clay, you're joining from Western South Dakota. We've got the state covered as far as news. What's the weather out there like today?
Oh, beautiful day, sunshine and calm, no wind and above, not quite above freezing, but above zero. So, all those things considered, it's a win as far as Western South Dakota days in December can go.
It's been pleasant here as well. I would say this has been one of the more favorable falls for, crop residue and fall grazing that we've had in a long time.
Yeah. That's what we were just talking about. Jared and I were visiting about still haven't fed the cows. And we're on December 22nd, and it doesn't look like they're going to be pulled off anytime soon. It's been absolutely fantastic. The other thing I've noticed in comparison to other years, the amount of protein that they're not consuming.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, usually I'm on, I don't know, you're starting to roll through the lick tubs and they're getting antsy and pacing the fence and scrounging for any blade of grass. That's just, they're much more content this year. So I don't know if there's a little bit more value left in some of the corn stalks or what the case is, but they're doing really good.
You were in that lower yield environment or yield limited environment
from
moisture. Yep.
Lower yield, better quality.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's some quality.
And is that increased quality due to lower yield driven by more kernels laying on the ground, or is it just the stalk? There's more nutrients left in the stalk that that they can get after?
Well, by forage analysis, there should be more protein in the fodder of the plant if it's pushed less yield.
Sure.
All right. Also, like I said too, you'll have those small regressed ears that'll go right through the slip plates.
That's true.
Poor yielding corn does have that more loss because it's not really meant to go through the combine that well. So a little bit of both, huh?
And some of the stock strength issues probably led to more down corn, and some cows are still searching for kernels, and that's keeping them a little content
too. Right. Did you guys have any of that wind that laid a bunch of corn down? Was that more Iowa or did that happen as far north
hit us. Yeah. Yep. That hit Eastern South Dakota pretty hard.
Us too.
And so a lot of that, they were harvesting corn real slow from what I was seeing, having to drive through it real slow. And I imagine it's still less efficient, even though you're driving slower.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Right. It was so a bit more of a battle, but luckily it was overall a pretty good fall.
And good time. Good, crop residue grazing opportunities, as you said, probably connected to that as well.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely perfect. Yep, the lack of summer forage has been made up here in the fall. We talked about that. I remember when we were sitting down with Jim Falstick in October, and he, commented about how much pastures regrew as soon as we started getting moisture in the fall there, and that was true. And then now we've had this awesome fall for, corn stalk and stover grazing. It's just, seems like, the law of averages does always come back and equal out when it's all said and done, when we look back at a year. And I think we've made that point here now as we wrap up the year of 21.
What are things out there look like, Clay?
Been an open winter so far. A lot of same thing. Not much forage grew. I mean, I think, if you can judge a cow's performance based on cow pies and patties and those kinds of things, my cows stayed pretty healthy and doing performing pretty well through November, but that was due to 2 inches of rain that we got in October, and that was I think that was our biggest single rainfall event of the year for us, and actually probably the biggest single rainfall event dating back to like June of 2020. So we would have been in a drought in 2020 if it hadn't been for 2019. It would have felt like a drought, I guess I should say. We had 40 inches of rain in 2019 when we usually get 15. And we had, I think I measured 9.5 inches of rain in 2020. And I measured 7.5 in 2020 before October. So actually that October rain put us over last year's total rainfall too. So, but still, little more than half. So not much forage grew this summer. Like you said, though, the fall moisture did, I think, help some people make up for that, but there's still quite a bit of supplement going on. And I don't know that it's much ahead of what it would have been last year. See a lot of cake trucks driving around, not seeing a whole lot of bales getting rolled out yet. But I think probably more people would have been rolling out bales now if it hadn't been for that December rainfall, October rainfall, where we actually grew some green grass and had some green grass for those girls to chase out there. So made a difference.
That's a real late flush of grass. That's real late.
Mm-hmm. It was honestly the most green grass I saw after after June. I'm not kidding. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
In October.
It was a tough year.
Yeah. So what's the stocking situation? I know that you go north and west of you, it gets even worse. You know, where would you say the average person in northwest South Dakota, and then even getting further worse, my understanding would be central or eastern Montana, you know, what percent stocked are people on mature cows, and where are they going to end the spring at?
Sure. You know, I've heard quite a few reports of breed ups in the mid to high 70s, low 80s. That hurts. I think a lot of those went as cull cows. You know, some of the guys that maybe traditionally would have held them over and fed them even into the first of the year, just to get past some of that big cull cow flush and the tough market to sell those cull cows in November, and December. You know, I think some of them went early this year. And so I think that probably as much as anything, it has affected the stocking rate and people backing have been able to back down by that and not had to sell as many bred cows as they might have had to if they had a low 90s to mid 90s breed up. You know, they might have been selling more bred cows than they were than they did this year. So I think that maybe is playing a role in the stocking situation. There are still bred cows going, but I would say the majority of them have been open
and moved
cold cows. Yep.
I wish they were bringing a little bit more money. Every time I see, kind of sale barn reports on those middle to broken, you know, solid to broken mouth cows, boy, they're just a heck of a value if someone can find a home for them.
Yeah. And do they go east? Do some of them end up in your country on in a feedlot getting juicy and then go to a killer processing
the
facility?
Opens for sure. The opens for sure. I mean, these bred ones, said, there's a typically a lot of, I'd say there's a big flex in the James River Valley and in eastern South Dakota and the Coteau where people will, you know, kind of swell up and, you know, take on a couple hundred here and there if they can. But again, it's usually done more so when things are a little bit tough, when there's a really good year from crop price standpoint in these mixed operations. It probably makes it a little bit harder to want to work your tail off, you know, having a 300 extra cows of unknown disposition history. So, I mean, and you don't blame people, right? Yeah. So there typically is that kind of flex there in this part of the country, but they don't seem to be having to fight over them because they're, like I said, solid broken mouth cows aren't bringing much.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And which is nuts. I mean, that you know, trend line, I would say, boy, if you can keep this thing going, it's in less than a year, you're guaranteed to probably have $1,000 marketable calf out of that cow. Calf's already there. It just isn't seeming to bring any premium in the market. Those cows would sell pretty similar to as if they were open.
Right. Yeah. You know, you got a lot of that winter bill, you know, into her, but there's still quite a bit to come, you know, and in this part of the region, there isn't going to be a lot of winter grazing done. So it's going to be that's going to be tough. All my cows went to Nebraska. I only had seven of them, you know, but we were just kind of getting started out, when we ended up transitioning over here. And I've always had a job, I guess you could say in town, although where I'm sitting right now, I'm 35 miles from a gas station. So, off ranch job, I suppose is what it is. But, I've always had a job in town. So I've gotten, you know, had just building up a cow herd and some of those things. And, we've still got the calves at the place. They're going to sell in February, but, the cows all went to Nebraska here a couple of weeks ago. So, I've heard a lot of people doing that. Actually a lot of them I think are really enjoying it. So I don't know how much of a battle there will be for corn stalks coming up in Nebraska the northern edge and around to the eastern edge of the sand hills where there gets to be quite a bit more corn put up in that part of the world. I don't know how much these guys are going to affect the battle for corn stalks in that part of the world, but I see quite a few of them sending cows to corn stalks this year. That is the first time they've ever done that, but they're kind of enjoying it because, you know, not having cows around that you have to, you know, feed and keep water open for in the winter can be a nice change for some of them.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, it doesn't seem to, I would say every year, the only time corn stock bales ever get a little competitive around here is when, as far as in the bale farm, I know you're talking about grazing acres in Nebraska, but Justin was just talking about, what'd you get quoted for delivered corn stock bales at your place, Justin?
I'd gotten some laid in for $40.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$40 a bale.
What are they weighing?
Oh, eight, they're probably, nine? That's what I was going to say, maybe not 9.5.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're normal big round bales, but
it's pretty nice. And the fact that you get them delivered in and it's like, yeah, it's, there's pretty good abundance. We have,
right. It's a good year for buying corn stock bales.
Yeah.
We had kind of two different flushes where, you know, guys could, throughout the season, there was that early corn stock baling right after the combine was rolling. Guys were getting a lot made. And then we got some rain, mm-hmm. you know, through much of the upper Midwest. And then we dried back out and guys got back out and made a lot of corn stock bales then. You know, when people were finished up combining. So there's a lot of corn stock bales around.
Yeah. What's a...
But that makes a big, big difference on, you know, when we talk about like our on-farm forage supplies and then just the, you know, the feed market in general and how big of a factor corn stock bales really play. It's huge. It's absolutely huge just because they, I mean, they're being ground and putting into rations for everything now. I mean, it's not just a stock cow feed. It's the feedlots. You see some dairies grinding corn stock bales now to use as a filler. I mean, it is. It's a big, big component of the entire feed supplies that we're supposed to put up in the United States.
So. Displaced a lot of demand for straw, obviously, for oat and wheat straw.
Yeah, you know, right. It's kind of taken that market, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the guys actually on the board of the church where I serve as pastor was saying that he'd gotten some corn stalks and he'd gotten them tested and talked to the guy that was reading the test for him. And he said, the guy said, usually I say that these corn stalk bales are better than straw, but not by much. And he said, but you happen to have gotten your hands on the worst corn stalk bales I've ever seen. So they are not better than straw.
Yeah.
But anyway,
they don't keep very long. They do not keep.
No.
They're you want to turn them around. You don't want to store them around a long time.
Sure.
Interesting.
Then the corn inside of there makes them a large attraction for raccoons and things like that that want to start digging in and finding those goodies. So
if you got somebody that's running a trap line, they'll be happy. But
yeah. Well, it's what's happened is the wheat belt, right? This eastern wheat market in this part of the world has been moved west to where there's a line where no one really wants to take the straw anymore, right? Everyone wants the straw for residue, for cover, for organic matter, for soil health, and then, you know, the people that to the east with the thick, heavy topsoil are not planting small grain anymore. So there's a lot more limited straw window. So you kind of needed to displace that.
That's true.
What have you guys seen in a year like this where there were some pretty sorry to say it that way, but pretty sorry wheat crops? And I actually messaged a guy, and I'm pretty sure we were on the same page, and I was asking for a wheat bale, like a bale that they didn't combine it, but they put it into a bale with the wheat, you know, with the head mm-hmm. still on it. And he said, we didn't want to do that. We couldn't sacrifice the residue. So did they even just leave some of that standing? And maybe, I don't know if they grazed it or what, but did you see some of that or hear of some of that happening?
I did see some of that kind of, you know, Potter County and north there. You saw some of that where they just didn't even go after it at all, but there was just nothing to go after. It looked like a pretty, you know, in some of those fields. But a lot of it did get baled.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember what those prices were at the time. It was kind of, there always gets to be these crazy high prices for wheat bales. You know, it's seemingly for what you think the value of a wheat bale would be. But those numbers, I don't remember what they were, but they always seem like ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the concern with the nitrates and everything that you've got to keep an eye on with those that make them a little bit more challenging to use as a feed source.
Yeah, but I didn't see a lot of them get grazed. If they take the water infrastructure out of these big crop areas, it just people haul a little water in the wintertime where, you know, they're not going through as much water. It's not hot. They don't have calves aside. They're not lactating. But summertime, you know, people don't seem to want to haul water real bad unless they absolutely have to. It takes a lot of time. You got to be really timely. You got to go through a lot more on a per head basis. So once that water infrastructure goes, it's
changes the dynamics of grazing.
Yeah, and a lot of that is our dry land acres. Is the lack of water accessibility there? I mean, of course, in the winter it's frozen, but would there have been pond options or things like that in that part of the world before all these fields got tiled? Or I'll freely admit, I've said it a lot of times, I'm row crop illiterate. So if I'm saying something dumb, you can tell me, but is that part of what's been impacting the usage of those acres in off season times?
I would say tiling really hasn't changed that. I mean, those have been shallow, you know, intermittent pools that weren't very good water for more than about the 15th of June anyway. So they're not great even in a wet year. Basically, if you're going to create a stable, you know, year-round or summer-long, fall-long water source, you're going to have to put it on a moving piece of water, right? It's going to have to be a dammed up creek like you see and that kind of stuff, a dugout in a creek. If you don't have some water flow coming to that, keeping it freshened up at least intermittently, it just doesn't turn out very good. The ones that are just ponded, they end up being real stale, real quick, really poor water.
Sure.
So I don't know that, and we're probably talking about a little bit different areas, you know, when I was thinking these big areas. I don't know that tiling has reduced the water source from a livestock grazing standpoint, especially not fall grazing, late summer grazing.
Just gotcha. Because, I mean, really, in some cases, it's helped it. You know, he can get lucky on the right side of some of these tile lines, and it's actually continued mm-hmm. flow through more some of these shallow creeks.
Sure.
So that just depends.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
We actually have a lot of restrictions in tiling anymore. I mean, realistically, like it's there's two sides of the coin. There's, you know, yeah, there's some real seasonal wetlands that get, you know, maybe drained out, but also we're probably making the other ones a little bit bigger. The ones that actually can hold water in year round by doing that. So it's a give and take. And unless you're willing to leave the farm program or do wetland mitigation or something like that, there's just not a lot of things that you would consider a wetland that are going to get tiled out. A lot of places where it's black dirt, it looks like there's hardly a depression there, and they might call it a wetland. So
yeah, that's true.
Yep. Sure. What have you guys seen as some of the top lessons learned in 2021 as far as some of the producers that you guys are working with?
Book your fertilizer early. I would say that for me, and this is over the last few years of working with people, this is summer, this is winter months right now. This is a great time to do this. There's always room to change a plan, but have a plan to start and do the best you can to stick with the plan. And if there was an opportunity to go reseed something, I mean, the normal traditional weather patterns that we think we have, like it's kind of early, you know, kind of wet in June, and then if it doesn't rain in June, it's not going to rain at all, or we don't get rain in July and August, prevented a lot of people from taking, you know, in situations where they could have had tremendous regrowth fall grazing opportunities by planting covers into failed wheat crops or into harvested wheat crops or into silage acres that came off early this year due to drought. And if you'd have got something in, you'll be flush with mm-hmm. extremely high quality, high protein grazing even now, yeah. For livestock. And so from that standpoint, it's like, well, the best time to, you know, to plant is as soon as you can, and you can't chase rains with a cover or with an alternative forage plan. And it wouldn't have worked everywhere, but the odds are really favorable that the places that were hit the hardest in the early part of the summer, a lot of those recovered late summer, fall.
Right. I think that is spot on with what we saw as, you know, I mean, the stakes continued to get higher as we didn't get rain, which made it even more impactful for those that did do something. Jared was right. When you make that plan, yeah, you're going to alter from that plan, but actually doing nothing was the worst thing that you could have done this year in most cases. And those that, you know, were able to take some risk by planting a cover crop after silage acres, they were rewarded here anyways. I mean, it's been phenomenal as far as some of those forage acres that they've gotten. And pushing the envelope as far as doing the extra work to fence off that extra quarter of corn stalks now. And, you know, those little things where it took effort and it took risk, those are the times where you were rewarded this year.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that those people, you know, would have been rewarded, especially with cattle coming from the West. You know, there would have been quite a bit of competition for those acres, I'm guessing. But
oh, yeah. And it always creates, like I said, there's buying opportunities. So there's self-sufficiency, you know, from your herd standpoint, but also the person who, you know, was able to be fortunate to, I think this is going to be a tremendous buying opportunity for anybody that can lay in extra cows and keep them for a while today. And I think it's going to be one of the last really good buying opportunities for a while. And so if your foresight and your, you know, aggressiveness and planning and whatever it was allows you to expand by 10-20% in a year like this, when everybody else is trying to contract by that amount, or from like your comments, forced to from extremely, you know, high open rates from on breed up, then it's great. And it might not happen every year, but it might be a once in a decade opportunity.
Yeah. Well, and back to what you said earlier, Jared, you know, and I'm sure you guys have heard this quote before from Dwight Eisenhower. He said, "In preparing for battle, I've always found that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great way to put it. Like, I've had these conversations with my dad plenty of times. He's like, "Well, how do you plan when there's so much uncertainties?" It's like, "Well, but what happens is if you don't have a plan at all, you'll just sit and stew, and then you'll be able to really effectively after the fact decide what you should have done a month before." But just not valuable. Yeah. So,
yep.
There's a point to digress and review, and there's a point to, you know, here's how and when we pull the trigger to move ahead.
Yeah, in the ranching for profit world, they use the illustration of a car. The windshield is however many times bigger than the rear view mirrors and the side view mirrors combined. And they say you should spend that amount of time looking forward in your business, sure, and the amount of time equivalent to the rear view mirrors and the side view mirrors looking backward in your business. And mm-hmm. And that is, you know, I have seen the merits of that way of thinking before. We were talking about weather a little bit. Don Day, meteorologist. Do you guys get exposed to his work at all? He's kind of a Wyoming guy, but
okay.
I don't think I'd have.
I was just listening to an extended interview with him the other day, and he was talking about he called himself an analog meteorologist, which means he takes into account a lot of the La Nina, El Nino cycles in the Pacific Ocean, and then also the phase of the sun. And he said that 2020 was kind of a triple whammy. 2021 was kind of a triple whammy, meaning we were coming off of an incredibly strong La Nina cycle, which produced 2019, which was a very wet year, very good year for us here in the West, maybe not as good for those in the East. But then on top of that, we were due for our 10-year drought coming off of the 2011-2012 you know, droughts we had in a lot of the West, and I'm not sure how far east that went. But then the third part of that triple whammy was that 2021 was also just a solar minimum, and all three of those things combined to make 2021 what it was in the West. And he said he anticipates the spring and summer of 2022 being a lot better because we're going to cycle back off of that solar minimum, and the Pacific Ocean is going to be more favorable to a better year here in the West. And so I think that was encouraging news for me. We'll see if it holds. They can't get a 10-day forecast right, so he's predicting 6 months in advance this better spring and summer. But you know, great. I'll take any encouraging news I can get at this point.
No, very encouraging. That would be fantastic for, like I said, for folks out your way into the West, farther west, to recover. That would be much, much needed, much needed.
And where I was going with that, I forgot about it as I was explaining it, but where I was going with that was back to what you were saying about the opportunity that's going to exist for people who are able to lay in some extra cows at this point. And I think that if we see, and I've talked to people who I trust a lot more than myself, I'm just a guy that, you know, I'm just the idiot, as Simon Sinek says, asking the dumb question everybody else in the room is wanting to ask. But a guy I trust a lot more than myself said, if we get some rain in the West, he wouldn't be surprised to see $2,500 to $3,000 bred cows in the coming months. So if you could buy in some of these, short term, or not short term, but you know, running age cows out of this country that's going east and lay them in and then send them back west. You know, that's a pretty good opportunity if his prediction holds.
I think that there's a lot of premium built into this thing that's going to hit at some point, and we've certainly been aggressive on cow slaughter, especially in the southeast of the U.S., which I think that's a region that once they lose their cows, it's going to be hard to come back, right? I mean, there's a there's a lot of timber, you know, a lot of real small-scale operations. Those could be kind of forever retired cows down out of some of those states.
I've seen people in my neighborhood where cows left, and I'm not sure they'll come back. You know, and I think that they're running cows and sheep, and the cows left, and it wasn't a small herd of cows, 160 or 40 or something like that. You know, not insignificant for sure, and they went to Colorado, and you know, I think maybe they'll be custom grazing cows in the growing season and running sheep from here on out. I wouldn't be surprised, I guess. But you know, that's not a bad business model. I would say, honestly,
No, not bad. The water situation alone is a lot easier to get a sheep through the winter than it is a cow.
No. Yep. I'll never forget, same guy one day after church, it was snowing during church, and he walked out and he said, "Oh, good, I won't have to water my sheep today. It snowed during church." And I mean, we're talking 2 inches of wet snow in the spring, and that was going to be great for them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It can simplify things.
What is the persona of the person that picks up those cows, though? I mean, moving forward, if some of these cattle are leaving the country and they're not coming back, and that person's retired and moved off and they don't have a next generation, where does ownership of the cows go?
I think somebody who's dreadfully understocked after the last 2 years in the West is the person that's buying them. Somebody who probably sold early on in the drought and has been sitting on that money for a couple of years, I think is probably the person buying those cows.
It's the least fortunate person to have to buy them back. The person who sold them at the cheapest, and the other side of that question, Justin, is okay. You look at the last cattle cycle when we destocked and then we came back and rebounded. We saw tremendous growth in South Dakota from a cow calf side of things. Right, South Dakota was one of the big net, you know, growers the net growth states when it came to that, and. Are we going to be that again, or where is it going to go? Like, where's that momentum shift, you know, kind of come back when there is restocking that takes place? Is it going to be, are we going to see a resurgence in the Southeast? Are they going to get back to where they were? Or who's going to actually be the states and the regions that grow on a net basis with cattle?
This is what, 2010 through 12, 13, when we started to repop again and numbers back up.
So 15 was the low marks, right? Remember, fall 15 calf prices were sky high through the roof, you know, and everything. So that was the $3,200, you know, straight Hereford, bred Hereford, Fort Pierre, sale barn, you know, peak of craziness, basically. That I remember that was 15, 16. And then that's when we started to, you know, get some repop going because of hybrid heifer prices, lot of heifers. I remember, you know, our AI schedule that year, you know, 15, 16, 17 was just through the roof because guys were going out and buying $2,000, you know, heifer calves or $1,800 heifer calves, banks vaccinated. And then there was a year or two where they sold them for $1,800 bred. But that was kind of the repopped years. But anyway, but the point was, I'm saying it was like South Dakota in that time frame was a huge net, you know, grower. Like we moved up several states in the ranking on as far as cows, you know, in the state rankings. We moved from like number 9 to number 6, I think.
Okay.
So I guess the big picture question here that I've got is cow calf the best thing to be doing in this part of the world, given our seasonality? And I'm all for people doing what makes them happy and what they enjoy, but just from a strictly economic perspective, and what our country does, you know, just on a seasonal weather basis, you know, is cow calf something that we should do at the level that we do, or should this be a lot more summer grass country than it is? I guess is something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I guess to go down the rabbit hole, the reason I've been thinking about that, I've just been wondering, you know, like if we were trying to mimic bison herds from before the settling of this part of the world, were they calving out, or were they here year round? And if they were here year round, which we kind of know they weren't, were they calving out here, or were they maybe calving out somewhere down south and then grazing this direction, kind of like some of those places in those mountain ranches in the West? You know, I'm talking about places like Idaho, where summer is, you know, 6 months long or whatever. You can follow the forage up the hill and be on a really high plane of nutrition all the way up the mountain, and getting some of that, you know, some of that better animal performance even later into the year than you might expect in those places where it's a lower rainfall environment. But as the snow melts and that green grass comes on, those animals perform well. So, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately. Is this really cow-calf country, or should it maybe be more summer yearling country?
Well, so the question was the permanent ranching establishment the best way to manage those grass acres, or was it a byproduct of the Homestead Act requiring a permanent residence and improvement on the property, barbed wire fences cutting off the traditional routes of moving, you know, summer grass cattle from the south to the north for summer grass and then back south again, and before the advent of the interstate highway system and trucks that could really efficiently move cattle? You know, was it a necessary window due to those dynamics of why people became permanent ranchers with cow-calf herds that calved and lived 12 months out of the year in your part of the world? Or was it a window? I'm not suggesting anything, don't get me wrong, but I see where you're going, and there's some factors that change that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it's just interesting to think about the effect of those factors on our current situation. And then I think that plays into another discussion of consolidation. And I'm going all the way back to, I think, episode 2 of Roots and Ruminants here with Luke Perman, where he said that management was the craft beer of the American ranching industry. And the way I took that, what I took that to mean was, as craft beer grew in popularity in the late 90s, early 2000s, management is going to be the thing that people are marketing in the future of ranching. That there's going to be, I think, where I see that playing out is that we're going to see continued ranch consolidation. We're going to see ranches owned by fewer and fewer people getting bigger and bigger, and we're going to see a lot of non-operator landowners, absentee landowners, whatever you want to call them, and we're going to see people marketing themselves as, I'm a guy that can manage this land, I can make it better, I can attract more wildlife to this land through my management, and you can pay me to do that, and I'm going to make this a show place for you. I don't know if you guys see any of those trends where you're at, but I can see that coming. And I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. I just think that maybe it's the reality of where we're headed.
I think it'll keep people, it'll bring some people back to beef, and I think it'll keep some people eating beef because of that, you know, that outlet, right? Which is probably true. There's probably a certain number of people that are out drinking craft beers that probably weren't big consumers of Budweiser. They weren't buying 30 packs of Busch Light, you know, before this, right? You know, they weren't big beer, like consumers of big beer, like quotation mark, big beer companies that are drinking craft beer. I think that's maybe true of, we might be able to attack that elusive salmon market, you know, from a consumption standpoint with craft beef. So it might not have to be one of those either or eat your own, you know, kind of competition schemes.
Well, I think you're spot on with that. And that's what we've seen. Because we've seen it with the craft beer industry, we've seen it with the craft food industry and the foodie market and the foodie waves. McDonald's isn't going away, and there's going to have to be a beef producer that can scale and work on low margins and produce a product that can be massively produced at low margins. And then there's going to be the producer that's got to have the Wagyu beef that's, you know, served in a high end white tablecloth market and, you know, bringing lots of value, but they're probably going to only run, you know, 50 cows, whatever it is. There's plenty of opportunity for however people want to create their product and however they want to market and brand their product. There's going to be an industry that can support it.
I wish ButcherBox, and I think that company's doing neat things, and I think, like I said, it is. I think a butcher box subscription, as much as you maybe you could argue that, you know, they're pushing for arbitrary things that aren't necessarily scientific, maybe some non-GMO or non-hormone. You know, there's certain things that they're selling that, you know, maybe they aren't great, but they're certainly sellable. But I think it'd be awesome if ButcherBox had a, you know, certified, you know, multi-species processor, or they supported that in some capacity in a region where they could have people with real small herds come in and process. They wouldn't have to be a 12-month supplier, because ButcherBox is going to give you, it's like fruit of the month. And so you're going to get your grass-fed beef from Perkins County, South Dakota, and it's going to come to you in November, because that's when it finishes, right? That's when the process works for it to happen. You don't have to have that 12-month revenue. So I think there's some good opportunity. We were at the National Ag Sustainability Conference, I think what it was called, in Las Vegas about a month ago. And there was a gal, and I can't remember her name. I didn't write this down before this, but what was her name? Anyway, she, her family ranches, and this gal was probably mid-20s, I would guess. And she gave the most compelling argument for the future of beef production that I've ever seen. She was beautiful, magnificent at it. I mean, it was just articulate and well-spoken. And she talked about how on their ranch, they had been doing an environmental assessment of all the things that were coexisting with their beef farm, with their ranch over the last 5 years. She'd been focused on this. And it was like 512 species of plants, amphibians, fish, insects, butterflies, honeybees, birds, mammals, everything that were listed out that were coexisting with their beef ranch, and then offered the alternative of, like, you know, and if you prefer to go vegan, this is our family's land. Like, we will farm it some way or another if we have to. But you will lose 511 of these species primarily, in every acre that we have to convert away from natural habitat producing beef into cereal production. So, I mean, the future is in your hands. And so, you can have these pictures, or you can, you know, we can contribute to more monoculture crops. It was like, oh, it's a gut punch. She did an awesome job. Mm-hmm. She said it way better than I did. I'll find her name. She's awesome.
I like that trade-off for an argument, though. Like,
yeah.
You know, if we're going to compare a system, or if we, like,
you bring up that one. You bring up a conference, and we're I think approaching conference season. The South Dakota Soil Health Coalition conference is coming up here in the middle of the month, and then also you guys will be with us at the South Dakota Farm Bureau and the Wyoming Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers Farm and Ranch Conference in Deadwood, South Dakota. You guys will be there on January 22nd. It's a Saturday in the afternoon, and we're going to be doing a live podcast recording with Steve Kenyon talking about cover crops and soil health and some of those things. So could you guys just talk to us a little bit about what you're going to be doing there, and then also kind of talk to us a little bit about the value of conferences and some of the ones that you're excited about coming up?
So we're gonna hit a lot about just practical uses of cover crops and get down to the nitty gritty of the how to's. And I think in some of these podcasts, we get to hear the stories of people's livelihoods and how they've gone about using some annual forages and cover crops. And we're going to just get down to, you know, start to finish some of the management practices and tactics of building these blends, and then the best use practices is of how to fit them in rotations, and you know, as far as field work and herbicide and fertilizer and all that stuff, and then, you know, go into some of the grazing and harvesting methods of those blends too. So that's what we're going to hit on with cover crops. As far as other shows, and, you know, there's some trade shows, there's some conferences that we're going to go to. South Dakota Soil Health Coalition's coming up with their conference right before that.
I believe that's Tuesday and Wednesday, and then the Farm Bureau Young Farmers and Ranchers Conference
is that weekend.
Yep, is Friday and Saturday. Yep.
Yeah, so we'll be at that one as well. Millwarden's going to have a booth there, and then I'm going to be presenting with some cover crop stuff, forage stuff as well at that one. We've got NCBA coming up, I guess, that we're going to take part in, head down to
Houston,
Texas, and go to that one. So I guess the winter is full of opportunities to, you know, learn and dig in on some of this stuff, and network is probably the biggest opportunity.
Black Hill Stock Show.
Yeah.
We'll be there as well. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a busy season coming up. Yeah. But we want to encourage anybody and everybody that's listening to this, and even those who aren't, to join us for one of those events, and especially that Farm Bureau, Young Farmer Rancher, anybody kind of 35-ish and under, right, Clay? Is that kind of the...
Yeah, and that's, it used to be called the Young Farmers and Ranchers Conference, and we changed it to Farm and Ranch Conference because it's for anybody. We are really targeting all generations, especially with this one, because we've got Elaine Fraze coming in on Friday afternoon from 2 to 6. She's going to do a succession planning workshop. So basically, the way we asked her to format this is we want both generations, or all three generations in some cases, of the operation to be in the room and to walk away with the framework for a plan to start transitioning the ranch to the next generation. So we really want all generations to be there. And I think it's an immense opportunity. She is passionate. She is good. She's been doing this really her whole adult life. All of her career path decisions and trajectory has set her up to really, I think, be an expert in this regard. And so I'm excited to have her there on Friday morning or Friday afternoon from 2 to 6. Then Steve Kenyon's going to be there on Saturday morning from 9 to noon. I don't know if I'll ever do a Working Cows conference. I've been involved in that on some level in other places, and I know how much work goes into those things. But this probably is going to be as close as you'll ever get to a Working Cows conference as far as the speakers that'll be there. A lot of past guests of the Working Cows podcast will be there. Luke and Natalie Kevorek will be there from Nebraska. And that wasn't anything I did. It was just the way it worked out that they were guests, and then they're coming along too. She's going to talk about social media and using that in partnerships with that. Ken Olson's going to be there. He's a fantastic ruminant nutritionist for SDSU Extension. He's going to be there. Justin Tupper from U.S. Cattlemen's is going to be there for a discussion about marketing and some of those things. He also runs St. Ange Livestock. And so I'm really excited about it. It's going to be great. It's always fun to partner with another state. We're partnering with Wyoming Farm Bureau, Young Farmers and Ranchers to put this on as well. But I'm passionate. I'm making personal phone calls. I just made 2 of them this morning, inviting people who are kind of in that transition season in their ranch and saying, come to this conference, bring the generations that are going to be impacted by this ranch transition and start working on a plan. And to that end, because we're so passionate about seeing that happen, we've actually opened up another ticketing option where people can register just for that Friday evening event. It's $40 per participant, and it includes the meal. So really, you cannot beat that opportunity. And not taking anything away from the rest of the conference, but if people were only able to make it for one part of it, I would encourage them to strongly consider that as an option.
No, it sounds like it's going to be a great event, and I'm looking forward to having an interactive time with Steve Kenyon, Justin, yourself, and I going through a lot of different scenarios and questionings. It's going to be great. And boy, as you get older, what do they say? The days go slow and the years go fast. Boy, when you start your year off, if you don't get out a little bit in January or February, I guarantee you, you're going to be back busy by March again, and it is going to not stop till Christmas. Yep. And so make the plans to get out there. Deadwood really, truly is one of those places that actually is nice to visit 12 months out of the year.
That's true.
It's fun. Winter in Deadwood is actually kind of nice. Yeah,
beautiful.
I grew up, my dad telling me all the time that we lived in the banana belt of South Dakota because we lived just on the northern edge of the Black Hills. And I looked at him a lot of times when I was wading through knee deep snow and told him he was crazy. But then I moved to the plains of South Dakota, and the Black Hills of South Dakota is a banana belt.
Yeah,
it is for sure.
Yeah. It melts.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, we look forward to it, seeing at different places on the winter road circuit, and definitely out in Deadwood for the event. Please join us out there.
Yeah, very much. And I thank you guys and Millborn Seeds for your partnership on that event too. It's been a lot of fun to see it come together. And I like I said, it's going to be good. Going to be a lot of fun. So, what are some other best of 2021 as far as educational opportunities or books or resources that you guys have consumed over this year that have really that you think people would get a lot of value out of?
Boy, I've become a big fan of Appalachia country music in 2021. I don't know. That's a side note. It has nothing to do with the podcast or working.
Give me a couple of names.
So like Shane Smith and the Saints. Like where these guys been? Like they have a album out, like Geronimo album from 2015. Never heard of them. Now it's like my favorite thing. There's all kinds of them. Cole Chaney, Mercy is a good album. I'd go back to Nick Jamerson. I'd have to think of him now. I wasn't planning on bringing this up, but go to my iTunes. Like my whole genre has kind of shifted. There's some absolutely fantastic music coming out of Appalachia right now. Blackberry Smoke, they're a little more popular. Ian No, Arlo McKinley, kind of an Ohio flavor.
Would Sierra Farrell fit that description as well?
I don't know. That's probably one to add. I don't even know that.
And she sounds like we're going way back, like Kitty Wells. If you've ever heard any Kitty Wells stuff from the 40s, she sounds just like her. It's crazy.
Okay.
So very cool. I like it a lot.
No, there's a lot of great music that's not on the radio. That was my assumption because I don't think I've listened to the radio outside of WNAX for SDSU football games or a little bit of markets in a long time. And so not to divert people away from local radio, but man, there's some good stuff out there. We'll get into some books later on, but I don't want to get too heavy into reading lists. I would say Michael Schellenberger is a guy I've been reading right now. Apocalypse Never is a book that came out a few years ago about kind of, you know, just general concerns with energy in the future and things like that. That's been kind of interesting. It's been an interesting year as we've launched our podcast. Just consuming lots of other podcasts as well, looking around, see what people are doing, hearing things. It's been a great way to challenge. If they say, you know, they always say the best way to learn is to teach. And this is, you know, kind of akin to that, right? You want to make sure that you're providing unique content when you're on the air. And so it's been a fun year to challenge ourselves from an input standpoint of what's going on in the world and what we're exposed to. So it's kind of my takeaway, Justin.
Yeah. And what a realization of how much effort it takes. So kudos to you, Clay, for doing 222 episodes. I think we did, what did we do? Maybe 10. Yeah, we're trying to do one a month, and that is a challenge. And so to get a million subscribers or views or hits, I should say, on your channel is absolutely phenomenal. It takes so much consistency and to stay that dedicated to getting a podcast put on all the time is a feat. So congratulations to you. This is just it's something.
Well, yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate that very much. Yeah, I think being first, and this is taking nothing away from people who were doing their podcast before mine, but being first is always good.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, being first to market is always good. I think the other thing is just that consistency. Just keep releasing episodes as much as you can every week. There's been times where I had more than 7 days, sometimes up to 15 days between episodes released, but I always tried to release two that week and get back on schedule. And I've averaged more than an episode a week for 4 years now. And so that's been, I think, a big part of it. And I've just really enjoyed it. It's been the greatest continuing education experience for me. Personally, just getting to ask, I don't think I'm really stretching it to say some of the best minds in this industry, what makes them tick, how they're doing things on their operation, and really drill down to a granular level at, the actual practices. I like these high level discussions, but I really thrive on those granular level discussions about, you know, let's drill down on a specific practice and talk about that for 45 minutes to an hour. So it's been good for me. It's been the primary way I have expanded my knowledge of this industry over the last 4 years for sure.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah. And I think we're going to continue to see that trend as people learn. It's learning from others that have done it before you. And that's a great, great way to learn. Great trend to follow.
All right, Clay. Well, we'll have a chance to talk again in a month and hopefully we'll have a lot more new things to share and get the opinions and perspective of Steve Kenyon, a Canadian rancher. So looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys again for this opportunity, and thanks for jumping in with us on this Farm and Ranch Conference. I'm really looking forward to it. I know it's going to be a great time, so I encourage people to head over to sdfarm.info and follow the links there to get registered. It'll be in the show notes page as well for today, workingcows.net/222, and wherever you guys post it, I'm sure we can arrange to get some links there too. So thank you guys.
We'll do it.
Hope to see everybody who was able to attend in January.
I really enjoyed that conversation. Some of the big picture stuff we got into towards the end really has kept my wheels turning, thinking about some of the way that the American beef production system has been influenced, just as the West has become settled, and how that's changed the way things happen, and about whether or not maybe those are the best ways to approach it, or if there's a way to be more profitable approaching it from a different direction. I'm really excited about this conversation next week. We're going to talk to Bob McBride of McBride Bucking Bulls about maybe a little bit out of the box way to add value to your cow herd, or how he's doing it. And I think this is the longest episode in the history of the Working Cows podcast, coming out next week with Bob McBride of McBride Bucking Bulls. We'll see you then. We'll see you again real soon with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.